Hello, everyone. I am Jennifer Braverman.
And I'm Ellen Selm.
And welcome to our podcast, Stories from the Earth,
where we explore humankind's relationship and connection with the natural world.
So I'd like everyone to take out your phones out there, you listening, watching in the future. This will only take a minute, and then we'll go on with the podcast. So please go down to the description and find the links. And if you have not already, please find your favorite social media platform and give us a quick follow. We really appreciate it. It helps, you know, support us. And if you love what you hear today and you have an extra dollar or $5 a month, please consider supporting us on our Patreon page, which is also a link. We'd love to hear from you guys. I work surrounded by boxes, cardboard boxes, all day, and I talk to them, but they don't talk back. And Ellen is home all day with a 1.5-year-old, so we need friends. We need stimulation. We need conversation. Please help us.
Help.
So if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, anything, please feel free to email us. That's storiesfromtheearth@gmail.com. We're friendly. We don't bite much.
Well, today we are finally continuing our chat review of the book Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist and Other Essays by Paul Kingsnorth. This book has a lot of discussion-worthy subject matter, and we've covered it over the course of a couple episodes. Today is part 3. And will be the final installment. So let's wade into the deep, shall we?
Let's do it.
I really like the story that this part 3 of the book opens up with. He's talking about going with his family on a trip to visit one of the cave sites in France where there's Neolithic cave paintings. With him being a storyteller and knowing a lot about myth and things like that, I'm sure this was intentional on his part, but the symbolism to the underworld and sort of the birth experience, coming out different and changed, exploring the depths that make you question yourself, trying to connect with the essence of something bigger than just mere humanity. Like, that's not explicitly stated in his story, but his story, I think, is really alluding to that sort of metaphorical mirror, which is pretty awesome. And I think it's also kind of a side note, interesting considering where he is now as a person spiritually. For those not familiar with Kingsnorth's background, which we've discussed some in our other couple of episodes, he was atheist. He practiced Zen Buddhism for a while, but in more recent years has become a very devout Christian in an Orthodox tradition. It's interesting looking at back at this, reading this book now, which he wrote like over a decade or more. Some of these essays are, more than a decade old. You can kind of see the underpinnings maybe of where he was going in his life, sort of. So I just thought that was an interesting side note.
Yeah. You can see like almost the thought process that he kind of is going through with this idea of
he's wrestling with meaning and
I guess God, you know,
that's, said, like, to anybody listening who's like, you know, might rear back at such discussion because of maybe traumatic experiences in their own life with religion, the book itself is not in any particular religious bent.
I think this is one of the few times that he actually mentions sort of religion.
Man's wrestling with meaning is also mankind's wrestling with, our spiritual history, too, in a sense. And he embodies that a bit in the book. As a little disclaimer, too, we have a lot of quotes that we're going to be sharing because he is a prolific writer and he's so good at it that it's really hard to pick little snippets. Like, you want to get a complete thought when you're pulling quotes from his work. And consequently, we've kind of organized our chat here for the sake of flow, but it's not necessarily exactly in the order from the book that the quotes appear. Obviously, they flow in the context of the book, but since we're pulling bits out, we needed to kind of arrange it in a way that makes sense for our conversation. And on that note, here is something he shared, kind of comments regarding seeing the cave paintings in person in France. He said, "I'm overtaken by a number of emotions as I stand in the black chamber, but the one that proves impossible to shake off is a huge sense of awe, a physical sensation that I did not expect and don't quite know how to handle. It is as if something age-old and darkly powerful has descended from the roof of the cavern and settled in me and will not leave. And as I look at the paintings and I take in the sensations of being in this place, I think that perhaps I begin to understand why people were here. I don't know what they did or who they were, but I can feel the power in the place, and it tells me why they might have come here. It seems obvious to me, and I think the evidence bears it out, that whatever happened in the Black Chamber was not driven by utility. Whoever was here and whatever they were doing, they were forging a connection to something way beyond everyday reality. The paintings are not expressions of economics or natural history. They surely sprang from the same sense of power and smallness and wonder and awe that I feel as I stand in the same place that the artist would have stood. This was a reaching out to, for, something way beyond human comprehension. This was a meeting with the sacred." Sacred, like spiritual, is one of those words whose meanings is easier to understand intuitively than to explain when challenged. My Oxford English Dictionary gives me a number of definitions, every one of them connected with a religion. This isn't quite right. It's true that if you hack away from the system of religious or spiritual practice that senses formed by thousands of years of human idiocy, literalism, and power play, you should find, at their center, a tiny, delicate thing, a sacred thing, the thing that these institutions originally arose to try to touch and circle or explain. So there he's starting to delve into that concept of the vastness of everything without pigeonholing it into a religion, that feeling that people can have an experience of wonder and sort of, yeah, well, we'll unpack a lot more of that here in the coming quotes.
And I realized that, like, he sort of started as far back as he could, like, not at the beginning, but, like, at the beginning of, like, people trying to get their heads around this idea of a feeling that there's something, like, I don't know, other than the physical or whatever we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. Day to day. So that was neat. So I've got two more quotes about that. "In much of the world, even today, and certainly for the decisive majority of human past, this sense of other than human nature as something thoroughly alive and ultimately interwoven with human experience is and was the mainstream perception. A world without electric lights, a world without engines, is a different world entirely. It is a world that is alive. Our world of science and industry, of monocultures and monotheism," monotheism, "marks a decisive shift in human seeing. Our world is not alive. It is a machine, not an animal that we have become, not an animal. And we have become starkly desensitized to the reality behind the asphalt and the streetlights. There are no mammoths outside the entrance to..." Do you know how to pronounce that?
My guess is that it's no.
No.
Because it's French and this X would be silent. Right. It's spelled N-I-A-U-X for our listeners out there, but we failed to double check our pronunciation. No cave.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Nah.
No, I think go sounds good. I mean, I could get the little Google lady up and she'd be like, telling us how to pronounce it. "So only a car park and gift shop. We are here now, above the ground. Above the ground is where we must live." And second quote, "On the wild hilltops, as in the black chamber, I pulled at the edges of some great force that seems way beyond me and seems embedded in the world itself, in the wild world of beauty and complexity and dark magic that my kind are busy destroying and replacing with cold, dead culture of future worship and straight lines. If anything is sacred, I have thought since I can remember thinking, surely it is this thing we call nature.
And I think it is pretty cool that it seems that even in these stages, you know, years back of him sort of wrestling with this, which I feel like a lot of people have a nature-based focus in life, wrestle with to some degree in a way, he hasn't lost that, I think, even in where his trajectory of his life has gone to, which
is yeah,
in his more current writings, I should say. I want to say, you cannot approach the numinous with discursive thought any more than you can solve an algebraic equation through the use of a metaphor. Sell your cleverness, advises the Persian mystic poet Rumi, and buy bewilderment. Cleverness is mere opinion. Bewilderment is intuition. It seems like good advice, and when I try to follow it, I see these things appear in a subtly different light.
I think that, like, a lot of these quotes have something in common that's just like there's something going on with, like, how we live today that's missing something.
Yeah.
And, so I think this is his sort of journey to try to maybe figure out what that.
Yeah, I think it comes across more fervently in this last section of the book too, because it's kind of what it all was building up to.
It's called
wrestling.
This is the last section called Connection. The last section is called Connection. So okay. Which makes sense that we're talking about connection. Science can show us the workings of the universe in ways we could never once have imagined, and it can change our perspective on that universe radically by doing so. But it can't tell us what matters in our human lives and why. And neither can it tell us why we see what we see and feel what we feel, and what we should do about any of it. Science might be able to tell us how to resurrect a mammoth, but it can never tell us whether we should. So in the book they're talking about some project where they're trying to literally, like, Jurassic Park style recreate a mammoth with science, which yeah. Sounds very crazy. This is a project that sees the world as imperfect and sees the duty of enlightened human engineers as correcting the imperfections. The end result will be a planned and controlled world of wealth, happiness, and peace for all. A rationalist utopia designed and run by rationalists. Probably we'll be able to live forever, having worked out how to download our consciousness into machines. Would there be much different given that we are machines already?
Yeah, we'll dig into that a little more too, because I know you had further thoughts on that coming up.
Definitely. And then anyone who's ever seen Galaxy 3-9, the anime series, it's pretty crazy, but it is basically like this little kid. Have you seen it?
Uh-uh.
It's old. It's a very old one. There's a ton of episodes, but basically it's this little kid, and if you board this train called the Galaxy 999, you at the end of the journey, you can get a robot body and live forever. And it stops at all these crazy planets, and all the people are miserable, including the people who already have robot bodies and different, like, models. Yeah. Like, you know, they've had, like, throughout the years, they're, you know, some of them are more like robot-like, and some of them are more like, you know, more human-like. And it has its issues, but it definitely, this is one of the themes that it talks about, like, you know. Yeah, I can't say I completely understand the show, but
it's interesting that that's exploring that sort of question of, like, well, yeah, is the grass really greener on the robotic side?
Yeah, I would say everyone's miserable. Humans and robots who were humans, and it's
and I think King's North is, when he's using the term machine a lot in his writing, he's meaning it, but depending on the context, he's meaning it one of both ways, oftentimes both ways, where it could be literal in a sense, or it could be in the metaphorical sense of just how we've categorized and isolated and boxed in and defined our way of existence to the point that we might as well be automatons because we're so disconnected from sort of the organic flow of everything. He says, "Perhaps I do, after all, understand the perpetual human search for the sacred, whether I can adequately explain it or not, and I think I may know why it still matters, despite my culture's frantic attempt to convince me otherwise. I've experienced the feelings that charge the concept with so much electricity. It's just that I've never experienced it in places that people designate as holy. Call me a heathen, I'd take that as a compliment. But for me, the sacred cannot be found in human things alone. This is not an intellectual or political position. It's just how I feel because of things I've experienced. From as early as I can remember, I have regarded trees, rivers, mountains, and the ocean with awe. I have had what others would call spiritual experiences in all of these places. I have yelled with joy in the heart of a rainforest and felt overwhelmed by something greater than myself in deserts at midnight with no light but the stars, stars that I can never see in my overdeveloped homeland. On wild hilltops, just as in the Black Chamber, I've pulled at the edges of some great force that seems way beyond me and embedded in the world itself, the wide world of beauty and complexity and dark magic that my kind are busy destroying." Oh, you already had said that part, but replacing with the culture. Yeah, I just realized where there was the overlap. And surely if there's something safe, nature. Been there, said that. I don't realize this sense. He says, "I don't idealize this sense, nor do I try to. I don't see it as necessarily a comforting thing. I realize that what I call nature, an imperfect word, but I can never seem to find a better one, is really just another word for life, an ever-turning wheel of blood and shit and death and rebirth. Nature is fatal as often as it is beautiful, and sometimes it's both at once. But for me, that's the point. It's the fear and the violence inherent in the wild nature as much as the beauty and the peace that inspires in me the impulse that religion asks me to direct towards a human-shaped God. Humility, a sense of smallness, sometimes a fear, usually a desire to be part of something bigger than me and my kind, to lose myself." And then he says, "to lose myself, capital S, i.e. let the ego go, melt away into that organic flow we were just talking about."
I personally don't need to melt away into the organic flow 100%, but, you know.
I don't even know that it'd be possible these days.
It probably, no. I mean, was it possibly for maybe some monk can do it?
Yeah. But even then, it's kind of like.
I mean, that's too much to the other side, I think.
Like, getting to a level of a, just almost a denial. And it's disassociation, but in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems to me that re-cultivating values such as these, rather than building toy mammoths in laboratories, is probably a more serious and useful response to the current crisis of nature. The crisis is at root a crisis of civilization, a crisis that has lost sight of any value beyond the quantifiable and the anthropocentric. anthropocentric. And this is increasingly proud of the fact. At this stage in history, we should at least try to find the words for what is so plainly missing. This is not an indulgence, but a necessity.
A lot of this whole chapter section, it's more like little essays within an entire section, so it's hard to call it chapters exactly. But a lot of what he says in this whole part of the book reminded me a lot of something that had literally just come up in conversation between my husband and I, like a couple days before we started writing our show notes. And I was like, oh, wow, that's sort of prescient. I don't remember what caused him to be reading something about it and then start the conversation with me, but it was pretty interesting. Apparently, the rise of what could clinically be called neuroses in the human condition has steadily grown since like about the Bronze Age, the time frame. Historical psychologists are like digging in and kind of considering the big picture. And the reason they postulate is because the more humans have become sort of secularized, for lack of a better term, the more they kind of obsess about death and illness. It's like when people had more of a, or even currently, like in our modern times, when people have more of an anchor point in their culture or their religion, or particularly a big marker for the psychologist's study was like some sense of an afterlife or something bigger than themselves or a sense of meaning and purpose. Like all of these things go into making it so that people suffer less neurotic illness, essentially, because they have like an anchor point.
Yeah.
And I think he's digging sort of a lot into that idea in a way in this whole section, because it's like he's wrestling with it himself. And I think, you know, we look around today and it's like, if you've come to a point in your life where you have wrestled and you do not and cannot and will not believe in a God or an afterlife or anything like that, that's fine, obviously.
Yeah.
And it could be the next step for humans, who knows? But I do think that whole need for like crafting, at least regardless of a spiritual context, a sense of meaning and purpose is like, if you don't even do that, even on like the most simplest daily basis, I think you can definitely see why, as quote unquote modern Western culture spreads around the world, that people have more mental health issues, you know?
I think for some reason us humans need some sort of anchor, some sort of like something to, I don't know, we're just big, big kids and we need like some sort of, we need something to hold on to that we can, I don't know, we need it. We need an anchor of some sort. But I mean, there are definitely people that are don't have that. And I think they're probably all right. They believe in something. They have some sort of anchoring belief, I think, even if it's not anchored in God or nature, universe, or whatever. When I was really, really sick, people were like, "Oh, well, we wish you had a stronger religious practice," people would say to me, because then you could, you know, you could lean on that as something that God will get me through, blah, 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 blah. I did not have that. So I don't have
that. And it's not like it's some switch you can flip, and it's not like you want to or should have to either, you know, like.
Right. I just wanted to not die, you know, or I just wanted to continue on really bad. Like it just, I mean, I don't know if I found an anchor at all, but you know, I went to my parents and stayed at their house. So, you know, I had support. Another thought was, I heard there's some crisis of like loneliness going on. And I don't know, it's just true of people just sort of feeling like they're very cut off from not only nature, but each other. Like we're sort of in these little boxes and stuff like that. Especially if you like work from home, or maybe even if you're in an office.
Like we have a culture, right? Mm-hmm. In the Western world, but we don't foster like a culture of belonging per se.
Yeah.
And I think we're starting to kind of see the cracks in that framework, because humans are social creatures, and we're not getting to socialize in ways that cultivate that belonging. I mean, social media, despite its chosen name, is not the same as like sitting around the campfire with the people you know well enough to call your brother, whether you like them or not on any given day, kind of thing, you know, like, but you're all in it together. Like there's a,
that's so funny. Yeah. It's like, it gives the illusion of connection, but you're not, and you are connecting in a certain way, but you, again, it doesn't supplant the going out for tea or coming over your friend's house for tea and a chat, or, you know, just, or having, right, you said, a group that you feel like you belong to, that you can count on. Yeah, it doesn't replace that, the feeling of being a part of something.
He attaches that more, I think, too, in the ecological sense with his experience in activism in this next quote. He says, "I think we're missing something big. Most cultures in human history have maintained or tried to maintain some kind of balance between the material and the immaterial, between the temple and the marketplace, so to speak. Ours is converting temples into luxury apartments and worshiping in the marketplace instead. We're allergic to learning from the past, but I think we could learn something here. The rationalist delusion has a strong grip on our culture, and that grip has been getting stronger during my lifetime. Every year, it seems, the areas of life that remain uncolonized by scientific or economic language or assumptions grows fewer. The success that science has had in explaining what can be explained has apparently convinced many people that it can explain everything, or that one day it will be able to do so. The success that economics has had at monetizing the things that science can explain has convinced many that everything significant can be monetized." Ugh. Environmentalists and conservationists are as vulnerable to these literal trends as anyone else. And many of them have persuaded themselves that in order to be taken seriously by those with the power to save or destroy, they must speak this language too. But this has been a Faustian bargain. Argue that a forest should be protected because of its economic value as a carbon sink, and you have nothing to say when gold or oil of much greater value is discovered underneath it.
Right. So you shouldn't argue that. You should argue that its value is that it's a forest.
Yeah, it has inherent value regardless of humans, you know, like it can be in and of itself.
When you can buy and sell everything, that is an issue. That economic system we call capitalism, it feels like it's a man-made system. And we sort of overlay it over top of everything.
It's a vice grip, and it's squeezing every little bit of everything out of everything. And it's like, well, you know, sooner or later.
Yeah, you're not going to have any more juice
anymore.
No, you're not going to be juicing that orange.
It's
going to be very sucky as long as we still got juice. The machine rolls on, so to speak. And the summary of that thought, he says, speaking the language of the dominant culture, the culture of human empire that measures everything that season demands a return, is not a clever trick, but a clever trap. Omit that sense of the sacred in nature, play it down, diminish it, laugh nervously when it's mentioned, and you are lost. And so is the world that moved you to save it for reasons you are never quite able to explain. I will say it plainly because I work myself up to it. In nature, I see something divine, and then I see it, it moves me to humility, not grandiosity. And that is good for me, and good for those I come in contact with. I don't want to be a god, even if I can. I want to be a servant of God. If by God we mean nature, life, the world. I want to be small in the world, belong to it, help it along, protect myself from its storms, and try not to cause none myself.
And I will say on that note, he gets to that point somewhat early on in the section, but I feel like he kind of loops back around to it in different ways with different words at different points then continuously throughout the section. Because I don't know, I guess in reading this book, I thought he might come to some sort of grand conclusion in his exploits that set the tone for where he was now and where he was going next. But this book, anyway, you know, and again, this is like 10 years or more that he wrote it. He didn't quite get there. He summarized things as best as he could for where he was at the time. And that right there that you just quoted is essentially what it comes down to, where he's just kind of able to say where he's inserting himself into all of it, or finds himself inserted into all of it, and staying humble, keep his head down, just do what he can. I don't know. In a way, it's like the think globally, act locally, you know. I would say if you're reading his book and you're thinking, oh gosh, this is hard work, this is heavy stuff, and I'm feeling kind of sick to my stomach, and you get to the end and you're like, well, he's not going to put a pretty bow on everything. There's no pretty bow. There's no light at the end of this tunnel. I hate to say that.
There's more work at the end of the tunnel.
But there's, okay, maybe there's no light at the end of the tunnel in the sense that it's like, oh, here's the answer. But there's light at the end of the tunnel in the sense that you can come through this log of shit and have some sense of orienteering where you are at that point, so that you can continue through the muck instead of just like sinking down into the muck. And that's maybe the best you can hope for. And that's kind of his point.
There's been so much work done, work and thoughts and people and discussion on like this subject. But I think, unfortunately, it's really still very hard because we know that something is amiss and wrong, and we don't like where our culture and everything seems to be moving, even if we're like figured out how we felt about things. Like we went through the whole set of process and we're like, aha, I've seen the matrix. I've got it. Okay, what do we do now? I think we're at that point where we need to take some sort of action. I think people just don't quite know what kind of action that is to bring about sort of some of these changes to shift the needle back towards more of a world for humans instead of a world for machines only. Now, the machines are not bad, but this is very complicated. Machines are not bad, but it's like how you use it like any other tool, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But I think it's why, especially this is even like, if this is 10 years ago, it's even further back. But all the people I listen to on podcasts still like, they're still like, well, we need to take some sort of action, but we're not sure what to do, you know, about this thing that we're living in and functioning in.
It's where he touches upon it a little bit in his book, but it comes up a lot in some of the other types of authors that I like to read, where they, and I think we've probably touched on it in other episodes before, but the whole concept of like humans need a new story. Like, it's good that there's more and more people that are reaching a point of voicing the thought of, hey, something's got to give. We just don't know what yet. If enough people at least reach that conclusion, maybe we'll reach a tipping point of where another idea or another story, so to speak, can blossom. And, you know, you don't know till you know, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
And then there'll just be this sort of collective conscious wave of like, oh yeah, no, like totally. Of course we did that. And right now we're sitting here scratching our heads like, what could we do? And King's right. North is in the middle of all that, because he sort of admits to not really fully knowing what we can do or that there's anything to be done. And he, I would argue bravely, in a sense, raises questions about like, what do we even really need to do anything? Mm. And there's a lot of nuance to that within this book I'm not getting into. I mean, you'll just have to read the book to get that point, because that's the overarching premise of the entire book, to not be summarized in a single quote. But yeah, he takes an interesting position for sure in the book, because it's like, it's definitely writing from an angle that I haven't hardly ever heard anybody else want to talk about.
Yeah, me too. Or when he does talk about things that I've heard other people talk about, he says different things about about them.
Raises a new question that's like, oh. Shifting gears out of the Black Cave and to further exploring these sort of ideas of the neo-futurists we touched upon, like the people who want to bring mammoths back, etc. Mm. He wrote, in his book, The Righteous Mind, psychologist Jonathan Haidt does a convincing job of demonstrating that every one of us, however much we might protest to the contrary, is fundamentally an irrational being. Much of what we believe to be objective, rational thought, based on an examination of evidence and an assessment of verifiable facts, is in reality the result of our conscious minds fabricating ex post facto justifications for what our intuition has already decided to do. But, skipping down a little bit, but to continue sort of in the theme, our old animal minds are still making the running. The role of our conscious reasoning brain is to provide the arguments to justify where it chooses to go. Haidt writes, we all need to take a cold, hard look at the evidence and see reasoning for what it is. It evolved not to help us find truth, but to help us engage in arguments, persuasion, and manipulation in the context of discussions with other people. I thought that that was an interesting quote that he chose to share because it kind of makes me think about how much of the conversation, so to speak, in our modern world is due to media technology and it wants to emphasize rational and arguing the facts. And I did my research, even if it's just YouTube videos, and trying to manipulate each other or the masses. It's like a larger sign pointing at the growing disconnect from intuition and from deeper knowing, or a fear of sort of the untethering of the ego. I think that kind of is in parallel with his point of how we're, you know, consequently becoming more disconnected from nature and so forth. So, yeah.
And you have to hope that those YouTube videos have done their research.
Right. Yeah. And that there's something that traces back to something that wasn't AI.
You want to do your research, even on YouTube.
But I think that whole thing is kind of like, you know, people talk about gut feelings or instinct, you know, and he's kind of trying to like dig into that idea that we do have, like we are animals. We do still have an innate primitive sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to call it intuition or whatever, sort of another way of going about the point that there's something more to existence than just the literal of what we can choose to manipulate for our benefit. But yes.
Oh, yes.
Ties right into all of that.
Yes. To the modern people, the world we walk through is not an animal, a being, a live presence. It is a machine. Our task is to learn how it works, the better to use it for our own human ends. Although I don't know if we're using it for our human ends. And then primitive savages who sang songs to the forest may not be primitive or savage at all. They may simply have retained an understanding that human-centered urban people have forgotten, that the forest is indeed alive. And not only the forest, the living world around us may turn out to be very much more sentient, aware, conscious, and connected than we have allowed ourselves to believe. As a writer, I wonder what our writing would look like if we took this notion seriously. I wonder, in particular, what our fiction, our stories would look like. What the world, that the world is a machine is one story, that the world is alive and aware is another. And that's what we were talking about earlier, about we need a new story.
Yeah.
Or that we've done the machine thing and
how much it affects perspective if you're sort of breaking things down into parts and thinking in that sort of mechanistic way versus thinking in a broader, more holistic viewpoint.
And we've just grown up in this, you know, with this one viewpoint, you know, geared very specifically to, you know, put us in the position for us to sort of get a job and, you know, be a productive member of society, whatever that means in this society. So in one of the chapters, he's writing very much about this book called What Technology Wants by Kevin Kelly, which I've never heard of this book before. And he says it takes us on a journey through the historical development of technology into a future in which Kelly believes technology will be a living force that controls our destiny. This is a book. Sorry, that's my thoughts. This is a book I never heard of. And I don't know. I included the Amazon blurb.
So this is the Amazon blurb about the Kevin Kelly's book?
Kevin Kelly's book.
Okay.
Yeah. This provocative book introduces a brand new view of technology. It suggests that technology as a whole, is not a jumble of wires and metal, but a living, evolving organism that has its own unconscious needs and tendencies. Kevin Kelly looks through the eyes of this global technological system to discover what it wants. He uses vivid examples of the past to trace technology's long course and then follows a dozen trajectories of technology into the near future to project where technology is headed, or what he thinks it's headed for. This new theory of technology offers three practical lessons. By listening to what technology wants, we can better prepare ourselves and our children for the inevitable technologies to come. By adopting the principles of proaction and engagement, we can steer technologies into their best role. And by aligning ourselves with the long-term, I don't know that word.
Imperative?
Imperative, thank you. Of this new near living system, we can capture its full gifts written in intelligent and accessible language. This is a fascinating, innovative, optimistic look, which when they said optimistic, King's North, that's not his takeaway at all.
Yeah. He kind of rips this guy a new one.
Heads up.
In so many words.
Yes. Look at humanity and technology join to produce increasing opportunities in the world and how technology can give our lives greater meaning. Yeah. So yeah, he's definitely not a fan of this book. And I am also not a fan by what he's, you know, what he says about it. It seems, but I haven't read the book. It's like free on Audible. It's really weird. So it's included if you want to give this book a whirl, some supplemental reading.
Give a little more context to that, King's North lumps this Kevin Kelly in with a couple other people that he says are part of the sort of Silicon Valley think tank of the neo-futurists who, you know, everything's rosy and merry and inevitable with technology. King's North just kind of digs into that a little bit in the terms of like, how much is this and aspects of science almost like a modern religion,
mm-hmm.
in a way that's detrimental, the way that religions can be detrimental because it's sort of dogmatic or alienating other possibilities. He's just not a big fan of the idea of, you know, resurrecting mammoths and things like that when it's like, can we not just try to fix what's here and now? Like, why do we need to be going and doing all this crazy stuff? Think of all the money and time that would go into that level of research, which could be better spent on things we already know will help situations and endangered animals or whatever today.
Right, exactly. We need to help the animals that are here. But even if we didn't, humans need housing, food, like, you know, there's a homeless crisis, climate change, you know, that's a thing. But these are some of my thoughts about this thing called the technium, which I don't think it's a term that too many people have talked about. I've never heard about it. But it really does sound like The Matrix from the movie The Matrix. The book was written in 2010 and the first Matrix movie came out in 1999. So I don't know if it was inspired by it or I don't know if you saw The Matrix movie or not, but So the theme of fear of technology versus the idea that technology will bring us into a brighter future, sort of, I feel like it's been around a really long time. And so I like watch a lot of science fiction. And I think, you know, a good example of fear of technology is from Doctor Who. I've never seen any Doctor Who. They know, there's this enemy called the Cybermen, and they are robots who used to be human. So the Cybermen are a species of space-faring cyborgs who often forcefully and painfully convert human beings or other similar species into more Cybermen in order to populate their ranks while also removing their emotions and personalities. Yeah, that's from Wikipedia. One episode, this planet, they all had these like cell phones, but they were like on, you know, earpieces. And one of the Doctor Who's like nemesis is another Time Lord, just sort of like flipped a switch and like the cell phone things like turned them all into Cybermen. It was just, anyway, they're really creepy. They're really, really creepy. It's like instant robot. And so we are very scared that we'll lose all that makes us human, I think, on a level. And so, and then in the last Matrix movie, bringing it back to the Matrix, is the Matrix Resurrections. So in the movie, basically, what the answer is to partner with the machines to make the world a better place. And so, but not all the machines are interested in doing this. And in the end of the movie, the Matrix still stands. But it seems like the first steps have been taken between a true partnership between man and machine. So I thought that was an interesting theme that that movie sort of brought up. And, you know, because it was like very much like us versus them, you know, and but then they start working with these machines to grow food again. And it's real cool.
I worked in a movie theater when it had come out, and my boss was like, I don't need to see the last one. And I was like, why? He's like, because I already know this story. And I was like, well, what are you talking about? Like, these are brand new concepts of, like, they were written, like, they didn't come from another thing. Like, they were written to be this movie. He's like, it's the Christ story. It's just the Christ story. Neo is Christ in this world, sort of embodied. And, I was so annoyed when they said that, only because it was like, I was like, oh, well, like, now it doesn't seem as new and inventive somehow. Now, you know, many, many years in hindsight, I'm like, well, there's that saying, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, you know? So it's like, humans are always finding ways to reinvent story for their current context in order to stimulate thought and educational exercises to help us, you know, in our current living, and or propel us into how to continue. And, you know, so that, I think in that way, those movies just kind of fall into that whole myth archetype construct, which I don't think is bad, but yeah, there's a lot of different ways you could pick them apart. And I think it's interesting because the movies themselves are ambiguous, right? Like with what you said, it's like in the end, it seems like the first steps have been taken for a partnership between man and machine. But then it's like, are you also left with this unsettling feeling of like, well, then it's just going to repeat. It's just going to do it all over again. You know, it's like, what is it, good? Is it bad? Who knows?
You know? I mean, they did say that, they said, you know, to the current architect of the Matrix, you know, you gave us a chance. Those movies have a lot of interpretations. And I think that the Christ story is just one. I like to just take it as like, you know, the whole, like, we're trapped in the machine and it's all around us and it's controlling us and we're not in the real world. And, you know, I definitely have a strong sense of kind of that a lot. I watched all four of them recently. I just was like, oh my gosh, the first time I saw it in the theaters, like, it was packed and like I had to sit in the front row and I was just like, whoa. You know, I was in film school and I was just like blown away. It was just so badass. We used to say it all the time, so badass. you know, so when he's talking about the technium, that's just what reminds me. This is some of the thoughts that came up. And, you know, humans, I think we're going to talk about technology as a tool later, but, you know, like he's talking about a spade and a computer. I don't know if he left that quote in, but like he said, it could equally be breaking to the human body. Like we use technology all the time. Like a book is a technology. A wood burning stove is a technology. A car is a technology. A horse and cart.
A stone to throw.
Is a technology. It's a tool. And some of the technologies are so useful that we don't get rid of them, like the wheel and the book and the wood stove. And like, it's just like, we're like, oh, books are going to go away. People are going to stop reading. And I don't know, maybe they have gone down, but we still have plenty. People read. There's plenty of books. People love books. And I'm hopeful now that like that technology will stay around. You know, like it's just something about this physical media. You know, I want to hold it. I hate reading on a screen. And I don't think I'm like alone. You know, the Kindles have that.
Well, even to the point that Kindles have the feature to mimic the color of a page of a book instead of a glowing screen. It's like, oh, it's strangely come full circle.
It's not the same. It's not the same. Don't take my book away. No, don't do it. But it can also be used for evil. And I think for me, I don't necessarily object to all technology. I object to some of the uses.
And I think that's sort of a lot of the point he's getting to in the book, too. As much as he's damning it in the biggest sense, he does kind of come back to making those points about like the scythe being easier to like mend and put down and forget about at the end of the day, instead of, you know, your primitive hand tool isn't going to harass you about your politics and
right. You're not gonna have to deal with it in the comments.
Staying on track with his neo-futurist evaluations, and going back a bit to his talking about the bringing extinct species back and things like that, he does quote somebody else. He says, in the Earth Island Journal earlier this year, Jason Mark came closest to rationalizing what my intuition is telling me. The de-extinctors might believe that reborn ground sloths or passenger pigeons would revive our sense of wonder of the wild world, and thus our desire to protect it, he said. But they were missing a key point. The Manhattan skyline at night amazes us with the scale of human invention. The Milky Way amazes us with the scale of the universe. They are both just an arrangement of lights, but the first makes humanity seem huge, and the second makes us feel small. The difference matters because it influences how we think about our place on the planet. The species revivalists, says Mark, misunderstand what conservation is really about. Taking some parts of the non-human world and protecting them from our unruly desires, above all, is an exercise in restraint, not in creation. Conservation is about forbearance. It's a demonstration of the discipline to leave well enough alone. Restraint, discipline, humility, forbearance. I know these are old-fashioned virtues, yet they remain the essential counterweights to those who would have paved whatever they could for the sake of a buck. Yeah, just kind of boiling down again that whole idea of perspective. It's like, there's nothing wrong with seeing the wonder of the twinkling skyline and going, wow, look at what humans have accomplished. This is just, you know, breathtaking, whether you agree with it or not. And, you know, whether you think it's a good thing or not, you know, you might still have your breath taken away. But that's very different than sort of the like, okay, knock you down a peg. You're a fruit fly in the face of the universe, you know, and in the face of time.
In his essay, The Etiquette etiquette. Etiquette. Oh, he uses such big words, Mr. Kingenorth. Come on. It's like I can read them, but then I'm speaking. Okay. The poet Gary Snyder makes a distinction between natural and wild. He uses the word nature, he explains, in its broadest sense, to mean the physical universe and all its properties. In this sense, everything on earth is natural because it doesn't break the laws of nature. I love this quote. The rainforest is natural, but so is a space rocket. A badger is natural, but so is a plastic bag. The world, wild on the other hand, denotes whose portions of the physical universe that remain free from the agency of humanity, which are as yet untamed by the predator man. Snyder writes that this definition of the wildness comes very close to being how the Chinese define the term Tao. Sorry. Okay. The way of great nature, eluding analysis, beyond categories, self-organizing, self-informing, playful, surprising, impermanent, insubstantial, independent, complete, orderly, unmediated, freely manifesting, self-authenticating, self-willed, complex, quite simple. So I do like this idea, you know, this cup is nature and this crystal is also nature, or like the plastic bags, you know, like, oh, plastic bags are so bad, and they are. But they're part of the world. We got them from the world. We used the materials from the world around us as very smart humans to create these things. Some of them are not great. I think it's an issue of editing and maybe some forethought like that. Let's like, oh, well, we just want to make a buck and these plastic bags are brilliant. And we just didn't realize, or someone maybe realized and didn't care that they just don't break down at all, ever.
Right.
Yeah. Only break down into smaller and smaller micro pieces so that we have them in our.
Well, I guess, I mean, in the context of that quote, yeah, you could say like, the plastic bag is natural because it doesn't break the laws of nature. But in the context of that quote, you could also say that you wouldn't say that the plastic bag is wild, right? Say that the plastic bag is an untamed spirit away from the predator of man, you know, like it is of man in that sense. So that's kind of where he's making that distinction of like, okay, well, if you're going to argue semantics, nature is nature. Nothing is outside of nature. But if you want to try to delineate for the sake of the argument being made that there is something that's bigger than just humans and the human construct, that's where you might use the word wild. And then he kind of goes on to explain why.
Wow.
And I like how he looped it back around to kind of relating to the Taoist definition and how you see that sort of back and forth where something can be orderly and unmediated and something can be complex but simple at the same time, you know. Well, I guess this is sort of piggybacking on just Kingsnorth digging more into those sort of separations. He says, because we've cut ourselves off from everything else that lives, and because we don't believe that it does live, we end up talking only to ourselves. We've ended what Thomas Berry called the great conversation between humans and other forms of life. We're becoming human narcissists, entombed in our cities, staring into our screens, seeing our faces and our minds reflected back, and believing that this is all there is. And outside, the forests fall, the ice melts, the corals die back, and extinctions roll on. But we keep writing our love letters to ourselves, oblivious. What might the alternatives look like? He says some more stuff there, but I jump down to a summary where he's like, the ecological crisis that we have spawned will unhumanize our views for us, whether we like it or not. The notions that only humans matter or that humans are in control, even of themselves, is unlikely to outlast this century. You put a timestamp on it. Everybody keep watching. Stay tuned.
Well, you know, according to climate scientists, we're going to hit probably, 3% warming by 2050 or something like that. They keep having the climate conferences. We've had like 26-27 years of climate conferences, and all they do is talk about it. They just talk, and you're like, yeah, this is obviously y'all are not going to do anything. Ever.
That's why one of my favorite pieces of art I've seen, the image circulates online. I do not remember who did it, but it's a cast statue of a bunch of people. I believe it might have been all men.
Oh,
But it was a bunch of people sitting in where like in the water. So the water's like coming up to their foreheads and over their heads, and the title of the statues of the artwork is something like discussing climate change or something.
It's like, well, we really should do something. Yeah, I think we should do something. What should we do? I don't know. If we don't feel small and humble by nature, we will be. I feel like
right. Yeah, that's kind of
that. It's like the record.
We can do our best to, you know, try to meet it with grace, or we will be dragged kicking and screaming.
Yes, it's like we will have to adjust our priorities and our perspectives. It's like when somebody's an alcoholic and they have to hit rock bottom in order to just make a change. And it seems like for not all of us, because I think a lot of us are ready to try to make changes, to be proactive, to sort of avoid a lot of the stuff that the scientists are saying that's going to happen. I think that our leaders, as wonderful as they may be, are not interested.
Well, it's about the short-sighted gains of what they can actually benefit from, near term or lifetime.
Right. It's more of a global human community thing. I know there's other cultures, like Japan is just learning this sort of now, is more of a community centered culture, and ours is more of like an individual centered culture. Like, we do things for us instead of the greater good of the community, and
as it extends to the non-human.
That's true. Yeah, you know, I mean, we see bears you know, get into the trash cans every fall. We're just like, oh, look, there's a bear. Let me get this picture. Oh, Byron Ballard had like pictures of bears in her tree.
Oh, man.
I didn't even know the bears could climb trees. They were like, they're young bears. They were like way high up. And I was like, well, okay, that's cool. I mean, I do like seeing them, even though, like, I know that we're like encroaching on their habitat, and that's why like they're here down with the humans. And of course, I mean,
in the apartment complex.
Yes. Eating our tasty trash. We have the best. We do have the best trash, I think. So, okay. Next quote. As you read this, the Earth is currently experiencing the latest extinction event in its 4.6 billion year history. This one, known as the Holocene extinction, is caused not by cyanobacteria or asteroid impacts, but by human beings. Yay. He goes on to say,
we're number one.
No, he actually did not write that. No. A little big foam finger that says human. I mean, today is the Super Bowl that we are recording it. So
that's why nobody's tuning into this live. Darn it.
They're all watching the Super Bowl at 11:16 a.m. What does this mean for us individuals? Is it our generation's burden to live through the last collapse and global ecological diversity? The knowledge that we are all complicit increases that burden. Simply being human at this time in history, and particularly being a middle-class human and one of the world's richer nations, makes you and me agents of extinction. Humans, agents of extinction. I think that's a good bumper sticker.
Like, well, so what do you do for a living? Well, for a living. Well, I don't know if it's a living, but
I'm an agent of extinction. Very fun office down the street. I mean, actually,
all the oil pumping out the back into the river, you know?
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. Sadly, I would like to be an agent of extinction as my job than what I'm currently doing. Although I'm also...
Well, that's the crappy thing.
I'm also
the agent of extinction, and we didn't sign up for this. I'm not getting paid.
Right, yeah, no, it's a what is it?
It's a thankless job.
It's a thankless job. It's just... Right, like, because I do it along with my job. Like, we sell a bunch of stuff that...
Oh, it fits in the context of his little history group here.
Oh, good. Okay, cool. For nearly two decades, starting in the early 1990s, I was involved in environmental activism. That is to say, I worked, as many others did, to try and fend off the worst of the damage that humans are doing for the rest of life on Earth. Some of the campaigns I was involved in were successful and others weren't. This was always a hard battle and mostly a losing one. But as time went on, the losing seemed to deepen. It became clear that green campaigns were being overwhelmed on all fronts. Such was the size and momentum of the human economy. Such was the need for growth simply to keep itself functioning. So, which was the level of denial and demand among most human beings who, despite our qualms, if we had any, would probably not have sacrificed. Most of the baubles and benefits of the economic machine was giving us that the chances of preventing the Holocene extinction from rolling onward came to see essentially essentially non-existent. Environmental campaigning, like any form of politics, is predicted to control. It is about preventing negative things from happening and trying to channel society towards what you regard as a more positive values and systems. It took me a long time to admit to myself that the level of control I wanted and desired simply couldn't exist. Governments have been promising to act on climate change for 20 years, and precisely nothing had happened. All of the trends from extinction to soil erosion to ocean acidification to reinforced destruction, we're going in the wrong direction fast. We, the Greens, knew that what needed to be done, but had no power to make it happen. It wasn't working. I looked around me at the diminishing natural beauty and its accelerating destruction, and I despaired.
The perspective he's writing from, right? He's been in the trenches. He's done it for this long, and he's seen so little budge that it's kind of why he, I think, ultimately came to writing this book. For what it's worth, he tries to pick it up a little bit from there. He says, a few things saved me eventually from this despair. One of them was a geological or even universal perspective. There's that word again.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to look at the world through an anthropocentric lens. Human concerns are foremost in our vision, bounded by our short lives and our everyday needs and desires. Among those desires is a concern that what we have always known as nature should continue as we have always known it. But nature has taken many forms. For the vast majority of its existence, nature here on Earth consisted only of single-celled organisms. The brief period of climactic stability in which human civilizations have evolved is just that, a brief period. It is not any kind of norm, because there's no norm. Had it not been for the great oxygen catastrophe or the asteroid impacts that wiped out the dinosaurs, or who knows how many other such episodes, none of us would be here to agonize about the latest turbulent episode in the history of this planet. So why should the state of the planet to which we have adapted survive forever? Nothing does. The Earth is a process as much as a thing. It is constantly changing. At this period in its history, we are the force tipping it into a new state. Now we're going to have to live with that state, whatever it brings, if we can. So that is that's an example of Paul Kingsnorth being optimistic. If you've not grappled with this level of existentialism before, it might not fully land.
Mm.
As a reader or a listener now. And if you haven't grappled with that level of existentialism before, and now your head is blown open, I'm sorry. But that's the rub. He's trying to say, and I've had to come to this conclusion myself, essentially, is that, like, that's where you're going to find the comfort. If you're looking for a comfort at the end of the day, when nothing can be controlled, you just have to remind yourself that it's always been constantly changing anyway. And in that way, it relieves some of the burden in that it's not all on you. Not that it is an excuse to just, you know, go, you know, burn down the neighboring forest for no good reason and dig up oil somewhere for shits and giggles. But, you know, like he's not trying to make excuses for that. And he does touch on that a little bit. But just that if we're trying to process the grief of this extinction event and our role in it, and whether you even believe that or not, the worry is a human worry. The earth is just the earth, and it will go on being the earth regardless of what that looks like.
Unless we, like, blow the earth up as humans, like, literally, like, just sort of, you know, shoot a big rocket from space and blew it up, then, you know,
that's still it changing.
That is true. But yeah, this idea that Earth will go on without humans. So even if we go extinct, you know, it'll still be there. And yeah, it takes away some of the power that you feel like the society at large has, I think.
Yeah. Actually, that's a better way to put it, I think, because rather than just thinking of it in terms of the individual burden of sort of blaming the victim is lifted, you're speaking in terms of, if you're the everyday person and you're mad at the powers that be, because yes, we've spent 20 years of climate talks and nothing's happened, for example.
Pretty mad, yeah.
He's also essentially saying, well, at the end of the day, those people don't even have as much power as they think they do, and as you're ascribing to them and worried that they have to mess things up, because none of what they're doing matters in the end either. This is a slippery existential slope here when he's talking about the word matters. Sorry about that. Reel it back.
It's like sort of an X factor. Like, we are doing shit, but which we could stop and would probably improve the climate and our chances of surviving as a species. But to extent that said shit has an effect on the planet, and it is something that we don't control necessarily. Like it's like an illness. I look at the planet as sort of having an illness and a health crisis, right? Like, so, you know, you have all the doctors and they give you the odds, but they can only give you the odds, right? Like, and then you could take the medicine, but like,
Will it help? Will there be side effects?
Everyone's different. So there's sort of like an X factor. You just, there's another element. To this, a third party, a third something, a third randomness, even the dudes in power who are just chatting forever and they don't do anything. They don't. Anyway, maybe that reels it back a little bit. So there's some comfort in that, like, you know, the scientists are only making a prediction.
In your next quote, kind
of
reels it back a little bit.
Okay, cool. I mean, they're educated predictions, but so it is hard for us to take in the reality that Earth is an extinction machine, and that it has been here before. It doesn't need us, and we cannot control it. The ecological crisis we hear so much about, and that I have written so much about and worked to stave off. Well, who's to say it's a crisis? Humans do, and educated socially concerned humans at that, the Earth itself, the Holocene extinction, is not a crisis. It's just another shift. Who determined that the planet should remain in a state which humans need and prefer? Is this not a form of clinging to the mutable things and one that is bound to make us unhappy? When we campaign to save the Earth, what are we really trying to save, and which Earth? And yet, something I've come to understand slowly over my lifetime is that nature, Earth, the world, whatever you call it, is not simply something I am on, but something I am. It is not outside of me, it is me, and I am it. There is no outside. Nature as a concept has always been flawed. Many traditional societies have no word for nature as something separate from humanity, because there was no obvious reason to separate humans from everything else that lived. There still isn't. Few felt experiences of deep connection with all life are central part of virtually all spiritual traditions, and with good reason. Nature is us, and we are nature.
It brings maybe a little more glimmer back to what he was digging into there. And a little more back and forth in his mood. You definitely get the moodiness in the book. He says, sometimes I ask myself why I give a shit about any of this. Why do I feel that the forests matter? The becks, the orangutans, the hornbills, the giant anteaters, the speckled wood butterflies. I always come back to the same answer. I don't know. And yet I do. I can't quite explain it. But I know that these things stir feelings in me that point towards a greatness that cannot be found in the human world alone. And I know that the possibility of these things disappearing forever from the world brings about in me a passion, an anger, a fear, and a frustration that is primal, atavistic, and probably as old as the caves. Because I am an animal, and this is my world, my birthright. It's my place, and I know that these things count, whether I can explain it or not. Those feelings, those passions, are a result of my embodied intuitive reaction to the world I am part of. They're a result of me being an animal in a world of beauty, depth, and complexity, and feeling that the external abundance is a part of my internal life. They are a result of me feeling, assuming, and knowing that the Earth is not a machine, that it is alive still. They're a result of me feeling small in the face of it and being grateful for this humility that it forces on me, even if sometimes it might be against my will. I have a feeling he's definitely probably encountered that sentiment a lot in his life and through his types of work.
Perhaps we will all end up as tin people or silicone people, all the old human feelings filled, and we will not know that it was ever different. Perhaps this already happened. Being human is hard work. It hurts. Being a machine must be a lot easier. Maybe this explains the apparent desire of some of us to merge with our creation. We're becoming machines, and our machines are becoming gods. So I think we're switching gears to another. This is from a different section of the book, I think.
We were going into the wrestling of, you know, the internal life and how the external is part of the internal in terms of nature. And so this is just kind of a contrast to that of like, well, you know, otherwise what, you know, we're machines and the machines are God, like, and you had some thoughts.
I've had some thoughts. Yes. being a machine is not easier because we're not machines. So, and I'm going to talk about capitalism here. My secret favorite topic. So I think that capitalism is the real driving force behind this feeling that technology is slowly turning us into machines, because capitalism is better. It's better for capitalism if we're not humans, if we are machines. Capitalism needs machines. It doesn't need thinking and feeling complex human animals. For the most part, even if you're not working in a factory, even if you're not working an assembly line, even if you're like more corporate, even if you're more office, I think there's still an element of this machine idea.
Yeah. The streamline, clockwork,
right.
Bottom dollar, efficiency over human. nature. Yeah.
Yeah. And for me, like, I've always functioned much better in jobs that are more, they give you more wiggle room. They give you room to be more of a person, especially since with I have ADD, it's really hard for me to, like, and maybe it's hard for all humans and not just people with ADD, but it's hard for me to, like, hit a target, walk a narrow line. I need the wiggle. I need the wobble. Even if, like, I'm doing a job that requires not really much brain power. It's just like if you lock me down, you're like, you must do this at this time, this at this time. I do need, like, some structure, but it's just like, it's just, I will not do it. I cannot do it. I'm like, anyway, King's North does not mention capitalism, but he does say something about the religion of progress into which we are all baptized at birth. And I feel like,
yeah,
progress he's talking about sounds a lot like capitalism, where the words can be used interchangeably.
Yeah.
The book is not about economic systems per se. And I don't know if that's what he meant, but it makes me think about that. And I've worked as a human machine for, you know, much of my working life. All it's done is made my human body sick. I feel like a lot of our health issues stem from the structure that is imposed on us every day by our jobs. You know, you must work these hours. You must do these things over and over and over.
Along those lines, if you contrast, like, different countries, like, paternity leave practices, even the United States has some of, like, the least, if not the least, amount of, like, protections and allowances for that time period of any industrialized country. And it's like, even the other ones that still function in a mechanistic world and capitalist society have some allowances for being like, oh, you're a human and you made another little human and that's work too. So here's some time and some money to go do that human thing so that you can be refreshed and more a functioning a member of the society. And here it's just like, nope, you're a machine. Get back to work. Get back to work. Get back to work. Send that little lump over there into the machine of daycare and well, you know,
exactly. They just
pop. You have no choice. It's not caring about the human element is, yeah, like the point you were making.
There's a fear about technology is that we'll be turned into machines, like, instantly, like the Cybermen. But I think it's a very slow process, and which is, I guess, comforting because we can stop it somehow. Maybe this is why we're so sick, which is what I said, and our bodies are yelling at us that something is wrong with how we've been asked to live, and we can work with machines, but we can't be machines. My work is pretty machine-like, but, like, I think about the people who do assembly plant work, and if anyone's read the book, if anyone wants to dig into this idea of work and on a side note, you should read this book. It's Stud Terkel's Working. It's a very big book. He's a brilliant journalist and he's a brilliant interview person, and this was written pretty much around when I was born, so about 40 plus years ago. And work has not changed since. So the nature of work, how it functions, these people, most of them, pretty miserable, and pretty much asked to be sort of a machine. It's an eye-opening read, but it's pretty rough, but it's worth it.
We're at a weird point too with technology, where and I guess the human relationship to it, because the apparatus of capitalism isn't quite ready to let, or doesn't quite know how to let humans be more free. Like, so if the theory is better living through technology, things should get easier, we should have to work less. Yeah, at the same time, we're saying you're only a productive member of society if you work X amount of hours and do these things, and you get limited this and da 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 da. And it's like, you can't have it. But, like, what's the, it reminds me of a video I saw, And I just remember I stumbled across it because like commenters were making like, you know, jokes about it. And it was this video of inside a Chinese factory somewhere where I don't know what the thing was coming down the conveyor belt, but one woman's job was to just stand along the line of the conveyor belt and turn each little gee-gaw that came down the conveyor belt, turn it to face the right way so that the next person on the conveyor line could do whatever they had to do to it to get it ready for packaging. So this woman was like literally laying back in her chair with her like her coat on her like a blanket and her one arm out, just kind of lazily and sleepily going boop, boop.
For like 8 hours.
And can, well, assuming, I mean, it's China, and who knows? Maybe she does it for 14 freaking hours, like, you know. And I'm just like, why does anybody need, you know? And she's doing it to feed her family or put a roof over her head, but some part of her is probably even like, what even is this? Like, seriously,
it's called, I
mean, have a robot that could freaking do.
Yes, the answer is yes. And the answer, the reason that she's doing it is because it's because of money. And the theory is that technology was supposed to liberate us from work. It's supposed to like free us. So we're supposed to have this, I forget who this theory is. I'm sorry, y'all. I don't know if it's like Marx or, I'm sorry. I literally forgot who said this idea.
We read a lot. It's hard to read.
I have a lot of time to listen to shit at work, which is probably the main pro of the job. Yeah, we were supposed to be in this future when people in the past, like the 18-something, early 1900s, were thinking about, some people, not everybody, were thinking about the future right now. They're thinking, we will have all this leisure time because machines will be doing this shit. And so we'll have to work less, much less. But capitalism has figured out.
You just get free money? No, you have to work.
Well,
how do we make these two things fit together?
It's figured out that like we can get more money if we make work more efficient, but we still have the people working. We're going to give you these tools, the technology functions tools, to make the humans more efficient, to do more work. So we're more productive now than we've ever been. But we also like have less time for shit and we get paid less. Guess who's making more money? Instead of this future where like we have time to, you know, make art, take care of our family, sleep in. I don't know. We've been robbed.
Yeah.
But I was going to say that, like, I like the idea, and I think we need more of this thing called cooperative work, which is a worker co-op, which is like you take away the hierarchy, you know, that's, you trash it, and everybody sort of makes the same pay. They have a say in the work. And so you can be more human. It doesn't deal with capitalism versus, you know, you're still working in a capitalist system, but I feel like it's better.
Trying to re-envision it a little bit.
Yeah. So make, you know, that's how you can sort of be more of a human instead of like, you know, push back at your boss. You might get in trouble, you know, in a hierarchy system. Even, you know, it's like, this is not a discussion. You do what I say. Basically, that's what they're saying. So I feel like there is some answers, but like there's so little, so many, so small amounts of worker co-ops. And there are some people trying to figure out some better systems that we could sort of implement that might help out. But like, I think it's a very small section of the population.
Needs an overhaul. Well, back to the bigger ecological picture, but really still, if everything is in nature, right, the rocket ship and the rain, then the capitalist dilemma falls under this as well. But anyway, Kingsnorth wrote, "A great change is underway across the earth. We cannot prevent it now, and its outcomes are not going to be pretty for much of humanity. The nature of nature has always been change, which means that death and rebirth will always be with us, and that rebirth may take forms we do not recognize and didn't expect. You are part of this process, and so am I, and this time around, we are the cause of it too. The future offers chaos, uncertainty, loss. To deny this is to deny reality. To pretend we have more control than we have and to cling to glib solutions as if the world were a maths puzzle we could solve with the right equations is a similar form of denial. There is an abyss opening up before us. It challenges everything we thought we knew about our culture and about nature. We need to look into it and concentrate on what we see. This is sort of that jumping off point of like, okay, and what will the new story be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I think the next quote you had puts out an angle from which to approach it anyway.
What happens if you sit with Earth? You reach down and touch it. If you call it as your witness, what happens if you let your own needs and demands fall away and see the world outside you for what it is? I would suggest that with the right quality of attention, we may come to know what is right for us as individuals and what we can do, what we can usefully do. This doesn't mean that all will be well, all will not be well. It doesn't mean we will necessarily end up with any less confused or conflicted either. It doesn't mean we will ever again experience the despair of knowing that we have done and what we are still doing and all of the things we are losing and can never bring back. But it does mean, or it could, that we are able to hold these feelings within us, to understand them and maybe reconcile them. It does mean that we can be done with denial and projection and false hope and false hopelessness if we sit with the earth, the trees, and the soil, and the wind, and the mist, and pay attention. We may know what to do and how to bring it, how to begin doing it, whatever burden we carry with us as we walk.
So there again is his little brand of optimism. It's like, yeah, it's going to be heavy, but at least you might find your way through it. And I thought that was good in his list of things about denial and projection and all that, that he says false hopelessness, right? Because just as much as people might have false hopes of, you know, a savior is going to come and, you know, magically overnight, all of the billionaires will grow a heart and save the world. Or, you know, I don't know. There's the false hopes, maybe, but equally so false hopelessness of like, oh, everything is doomed, you know. His point, it's more of like, yeah, but what is everything? The earth's always changing, you know. What is doom really in that context? And if you stay stuck in that, in the false hopelessness, you're not helping either. You know,
right.
So you got to carry the burden, but you keep going.
Yeah, you need to really try to look at things and try to see what's going on, and then you can go from there. You know, but not looking at it, ignoring it, not helpful. It's better to know, even if it's awful. That's what I'm trying to say. It's better to know, even if it's awful, because then you can work to make it better if you're able to.
Like, well, you at least have a place from which to act from, or at least exist from.
Yes.
Instead of being like completely in the dark.
Yes.
As a sort of summary final quote, and we had a lot of other quotes picked out, but this is, as you know, already gone on quite long, but this is a good summary quote to end on, because it is, I believe, I pulled this one from the epilogue of the book, and his tone changes from an I perspective to a we, and the reason it changes to a we is because at this point he had started his Dark Mountain project, which was sort of a book publication of essays and artwork.
Still going on.
It's still going on. He's no longer part of it. He turned it over to, I think, his partner who helped him found it, and some other folks. But it's just a collection of works that explore these sort of like, where are humans now and what are we doing? He's now speaking as a we, as in we from the Dark Mountain Project. And that's where this quote's coming from. But today, humanity is up to its neck in denial about what it has built, what it has become, and what it is in for. ecological and economic collapse unfold before us, and if we acknowledge them at all, we act as if it's a temporary problem, a technical glitch. Centuries of hubris block our ears like wax plugs. We cannot hear the message which reality is screaming at us. For all of our doubts and discontents, we are still wired to the idea of a history in which the future will be an upgraded version of the present. The assumption remains that things must continue in their current direction. The sense of crisis only smudges the meaning of that must. No longer a natural inevitability, it becomes an urgent necessity. We must find a way to go on having supermarkets and superhighways. That's where our thoughts are limited. We cannot contemplate the alternative. And so we find ourselves, all of us together, poised, trembling on the edge of change so massive that we have no way of gauging it. None of us knows where to look, but all of us know that we don't want to look down. Secretly, we all think we're doomed. Even the politicians think this. Even the environmentalists. Some of us deal with this by going shopping. Some deal with it by hoping it's true. Some give up in despair. Some work frantically to try and fend off the coming storm. Our question is, what would happen if we looked down? Would it be as bad as we imagine? What might we see? Could it even be good for us? We believe it's time to look down.
Time to look down or go shopping.
Oh, I'll look down tomorrow.
There's that book, that movie, Don't Look Up.
Yeah.
That's, I guess, also like a similar theme here. Like,
and hopefully we didn't drag anybody too down on their Sunday morning / afternoon. He has his glimmers, despite the overarching seeming tone. It is a very important take on the situation. I think people, it would behoove most people to read this book.
I think so. He's just one of those authors that like has, and I've said it before, but he sort of has put thoughts that I've had in my head into words in a very, very eloquent way.
And you have to go into reading it open-minded. And if it makes you uncomfortable and squirm in your seat a little bit, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
It means it's challenging something maybe that needs to be challenged.
I mean, it's like the book Working that I mentioned. I think this book is pretty hard to read. I think it's important for anyone who's working at 9 to 5 and feels sort of dissatisfied with the way that work was. And it's a history of work, and you know, and so I'm sorry. Yeah, my brain is just about stopped working, speaking of working, because we have thought so many big thoughts. But really, it's very readable. It's very approachable. So if you're interested in any of the topics that we've brought up, and if you haven't listened to our other two episodes on this book, please do. This is part 3. So we finally got to it, and I'm sorry people were waiting for it, that it took us a year.
Well, we squeezed in some pretty cool interviews. We had to make room for some awesome people. And
Yeah, definitely.
And
definitely.
I think we had to digest the book a little bit before
yes.
we reached the harrowing conclusion.
Yeah, because there is a ton in here. Like, literally, like, I can highlight the whole... Yes, Kitty. He's like, pet me. You stop petting me. What are you doing? I can literally highlight a whole essay. So it's just, oh gosh. All right. So on that note, we'd like to thank everyone for listening and watching. This episode has been live today. Perhaps we will do more live. So stay tuned. I'll put up a post about it. And you can follow. Ow, Kitty. That hurts. He's not helping. He's like distracting me even more. Okay. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on YouTube, on Facebook. We have a group. We're on Instagram, and we're also on TikTok. So we appreciate your follow and your support. And again, we'd like to invite our listeners to consider supporting us through a little donation. You can go to our Patreon page and click the support button. And you can donate $1, $5, or $10. And the donation goes towards helping us with future projects, such as taking the show on the road and doing more of these live on-site reviews and interviews. And we also appreciate that. You can leave us a review and or in a rating on Apple Podcasts. That also helps support the show. I guess until next time, where we will probably be diving into slightly much lighter content. I can't remember what our next planned episode is. We will talk to you later. So thanks so much for everyone watching this morning. And happy Sunday morning. have a good rest of your Sunday. Have a good Super Bowl.
Go sit with the earth.
Go sit with the earth. You can do it at the same time as you watch the Super Bowl if you bring your cell phone outside. So, you know.
Or just do it at the halftime show.
That is true. It's going to be Usher. Unless you like Usher. Sorry. All right. We'll talk to you later. Bye. Eugene says bye too. Yeah.